This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Jordan Bell. Every so often on Issues and Ideas, we like to showcase a local author, and we're very lucky on the Central Coast to have many local poets and creative writers here. Joining us today is Cal Poly Professor Emeritus George Kotkin. He's a former history professor in the College of Liberal Arts, and he's just written a new book to add to his many books and essays. It's called Feast of Excess, and a cultural history of the new sensibility, in which he discusses several American cultural icons and the creation of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Welcome to Issues and Ideas.
Thank you for having me, Jordan.
Well, so I want to start by talking about your book's title, Feast of Excess, a cultural history of the new sensibility. Why that title?
Well, I like the notion of a feast, and I think a feast of excess has different suggestions. One, that of course you can be incredibly satisfied with all of this food and take absolute delight in it, in which case it would be outstanding. But as if you know from like the movie Satyricon many years ago, feasts can also be overwhelming, and sometimes you can walk away from them bloated, outraged, and sick. And so I wanted to capture the dual meaning of feast, and the book is really about the development of excess in American culture.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about a few of the icons you showcase in your book?
Yeah. What I wanted to do was to capture different cultural figures, either at the moment of artistic conception when they were doing a piece, thinking about it, or realizing it, or at the moment when it had been popularized, had just come out. And so I came upon this idea of having, I guess, 24 chapters, something like that, each fairly brief, each one devoted to a year, with generally one or two artists for a particular year. And I'm not saying that the new sensibility began absolutely with John Cage, but John Cage is such a fascinating figure. And 1952 was a year in which he did both his great piece 4:33, 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, and he also did what was in effect the first happening that year. And then I decided that you about reached the breaking point with someone like Chris Burden in 1974. Among the pieces that he had done were to have himself locked for a few days in a locker. Another piece that he did was to have himself shot at close range with a .22 caliber rifle. In between, I tried to deal with figures from literature like Patricia Highsmith, William Styron, other artists, Robert Rauschenberg, Andy Warhol. It tries to run the gamut of culture to give us a sense of how this thing called the new sensibility was expressing itself in American culture. The new sensibility, of course, may need some defining, and that's not so easy to do, but I'll try.
All right.
Around 65, Susan Sontag, who is part of the book, came up with this notion of the new sensibility, and she published an essay on it in, of all places, Mademoiselle magazine. And she had also written an essay about camp and the importance of camp. Well, that same year, Tom Wolfe, the man in the white suit and later became very famous, also talked about the new sensibility, but they saw it in different aspects of American culture. For Sontag, the new sensibility dealt with high art. It was about Andy Warhol movies being 7 hours long. It was about the theater of the absurd. It was about Samuel Beckett's literature and how silence was in some ways superior to prose. For Wolfe, it was in the pulsating excitement of stock car racing, in the artistry of people who, you know, paint cars, that kind of thing. But they both hit on something that struck me as meaningful, that is, that they were looking at a culture that seemed to be embarking on extremes. And the extremes could go in two directions. One was a minimalist direction, like John Cage. I mean, you can't get any more minimalist, I suppose, than having a pianist sit a piano and not strike a key for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And then it was maximalist. You think about the final scene I guess it's the final scene in Bonnie and Clyde, where you have this ballet of bullets that are, you know, they're going everywhere and the bodies are writhing. You have that. So that's excess. Getting yourself shot strikes me as excessive. Some of the things that were going on in films and in literature were excessive. Thomas Pynchon, his novel Gravity's Rainbow, is a brilliant work, but I think by anyone's standards, it's excessive in terms of its metaphors, its leaps, it's playing with pornography, all that kind of stuff. So I wanted to look at those two extremes of what I called the new sensibility. And then I noticed that there were different, like, content. There was new things seemed to be at the center of the American cultural mind, or at least some parts of that mind. Violence, liberation, sexuality, blurring genres between high and low art, opening up the culture to pure pleasure, things that had been perhaps less central suddenly came to define our culture. And then I suppose, as I suggest in the conclusion, if we're looking for the origins of our culture today, what we have, maybe it's found in the new sensibility.
Mm-hmm. And you write, you wrote an article in Salon magazine recently about the new sensibility in which you outline those two concepts from both those two icons.
Yeah, and today I just had a piece come up where I think I may have gone too far.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote a piece about how Miley Cyrus might be related to the new sensibility, but I think it probably would have been wiser to do a piece about David Bowie. I mean, you know, David Bowie died last week. And so I was reading all these obituaries and things, and they had some interviews with him. Mm-hmm. And in this one interview, I guess it's in Vanity Fair, they ask you these canned questions, yeah, like, what journey would you like to take? And he said, I'd like to go on the road to artistic excess.
Huh.
And so in that way, he's perfect. And of course, he was very much aware of Warhol. He's very much aware of blurring identities, of going and taking things too far, of So he inherited in many ways the new sensibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you're obviously studied history, you, as that being, you know, your life's profession, I suppose. Now, what sort of research in history and things you had to learn to write this book? What sorts of things did you have to do?
Well, I have a short attention span, mm-hmm, and that can be helpful with certain projects. For example, when I did this book on Moby Dick, I decided I would mimic the number of chapters that are in Moby Dick. So there are 135 chapters, so I had 135, thankfully, short chapters, plus an epilogue and extracts and an etymology. When I was thinking about this book, I was going to do it originally as a kind of straight reception history, you know. And then as I thought about it, I thought, you know, it'd be nice to spend time with each of these figures and to try and catch them, like I said, at the moment of creation or the moment when it was coming out, and to blend biography and analysis. I'm not saying that, you know, if we understand the person's background, we understand their work, nor that if we understand the person's work, we understand their background. But the intermingling of the two is what interested me. So to get back to your question, I wanted to extend my reach as far as I could in terms of trying to bring in a diverse group of figures who I thought exemplified in some way an aspect of the new sensibility. And the new sensibility was so wide, I realized that there was no one figure that you could say, ah, that's the essence of the sensibility. So it was kind of like, by having these different chapters, I might come up with a roster of the new sensibility. And certainly others could have been included to replace the ones that I had.
Okay.
So it's a starting point in that sense.
Yes. If you're just joining us on Issues and Ideas, our guest is George Kotkin. He's just written a new book, Feast of Excess, A Cultural History of the New Sensibility, about cultural icons in the rise of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now, I read an excerpt from your book in which you sort of compare Bob Dylan and John Coltrane, and you provide context about the year 1965, and we're on this, like, you know, the economy is good, but there's also this, like, political and social backdrop that's influenced influencing music of both those artists. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, 1965 and 64 are important years for Coltrane and for Dylan. And both of them are breaking away from what they've been doing previously. Now, much to the chagrin of traditional jazz fans for Coltrane, and much to the shock of many folk music people. And so I liked it that they were coming together in that sense, and both were trying to do new things. And the chapter is predicated on the opening that, you know, how does it feel to be booed, which, you know, Dylan was, of course, responding to in some of his songs from that period. Dylan is moving away from being fit into a conceptual box of a protest singer. And at this point, he's doing some of his most intriguing work. Coltrane is moving in spiritual directions, but in ways that are just so unpredictable and so avant-garde that it's almost impossible to describe them. And so I saw the two as going on a similar route. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to capture that. And the excitement that it was for them, you know, the excitement in that recording studio, the moment that I think it was Al Kooper comes up with that great opening organ line for Like a Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. And when Coltrane brings in all these wonderful artists to work with him, and they recite, you know, the religious words, and he writes the copy for the album cover, Love Supreme. You know, just, it was just an amazing moment. And there are just so many of them in this period. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to capture.
Yeah.
Or try to.
Yeah. And as I was reading it, I was thinking about how, you know, this week we're celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King, and a lot of, you know, his work was combined in those times with what a lot of these artists were singing about. Mm-hmm. And being so much younger, I never lived through these generations, and really my parents hadn't. So, like, how I relate to these things would be in what I imagine as current day civil rights movements, social movements. I'm wondering if you see any connection between what we see today with, like, the Black Lives Matter movement and current music, whether it be mm-hmm. hip-hop or, you know, any artists,
sure.
really.
Well, let me backtrack and then sure. come back and remind me if I forget. In the chapter on 1962, it's the only chapter where I deal with many figures rather than one or two. And the reason for that is one thing that became increasingly clear as I wrote about these figures in the 50s and 60s mm-hmm. was the centrality of the nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. the fear of nuclear warfare. And in 1962, you're much too young to remember this, but I actually remember it as a kid walking home from school in the Bronx, and it was cloudy days in October, and there was a sense of that the world might end instantly. Well, Dylan, at that point, was sitting in a cafe in Greenwich Village writing a letter to his girlfriend who was in Italy talking about this kind of reality. And a book came out in 1962 by a think tank fellow by the name of Herman Kahn called Thinking the Unthinkable. Mm-hmm. And his argument was that you could basically survive a nuclear holocaust. When I put all that together in the chapter on 1962, which is also when you have civil rights activity, you know, the sense that the times they are changing, you know, Dylan's mm-hmm. famous line, I ended that chapter in an odd way because on the night when the Soviet ships might rendezvous with the American ships and trigger a nuclear holocaust, and it came awfully close, James Brown was singing at the Apollo Theater. Mm-hmm. And James Brown was absolute pure energy. You know, he captured in some aspects the new sensibility. And, you know, in this one song, he says, please, 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 over and over again, maybe 30, 40 times. So you get that sense of repetition as a new form of art. And that was one or an aspect of art. And you get that in many other figures in this period, like Andy Warhol in his own mode. You know, he sets up a camera for 7 hours and fixes it on the Empire State Building. And that's it. That's the film. Well, the assumption being that repetition or even the same thing just continuing without with only the most minor changes, like a cloud floating by or a light changing, that can affect the viewing experience, and that maybe change us and change the way we perceive things, open us up to new things. So that's what they were doing. And of course, the civil rights movement was absolutely central for opening up the minds of many American artists to cultural possibilities. I'm not as familiar as I should be with hip-hop, but when you think of certain themes that the New Sensibility was more than flirting with, like violence, at least in the early hip-hop, and mm-hmm. you know, and when it started in the Bronx and then with Run DMC and other groups, this notion that violence is something that is both liberating and in its own odd way pleasurable relates to things that Norman Mailer was saying in a ridiculous but penetrating essay of 1957, I think, called The White Negro. Mm-hmm. So you can draw these lines between what's happening today and what's happening in previous times, and the notion that in order to reach an audience, there's a performative aspect. That is, that it's not just reasoned argument. It's not deep interpretation, that it's also certain kinds of action, so that the living theater wanted to involve the audience in the plays. And they would, in 69, in one of their plays, they would have the audience come on the stage and they would disrobe and they would dance with the audience, and it would almost be like an orgy. Mm-hmm. The Living Theater earlier in a play had done a thing where during it was a play about waiting for drugs called The Connection, and they would have the actors mingle with the audience in the intermission and hit them up for money to buy drugs, and some people say that the actors were using drugs on stage. Well, Black Lives Matter just the other day closed down, I think it was the Bay Bridge, right, yesterday, had a major demonstration to, so that would be in that performative vein. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think there are links.
Yeah, certain parallels, yeah. Mm-hmm. And another thing that you've alluded to throughout this interview, but that you touch on in your book, is that going to extremes with art is necessary. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that also. Okay.
Well, there's that great one title that I was thinking about for the book, and I ended up with Feast of Excess, mm-hmm. getting back to your first question, was Gone Too Far. And there's that wonderful moment where John Cage's 433 is being performed, and his mother, Lucretia Cage, who's quite a sharp cookie, had attended the performance with a friend. And after the performance, she turns to this friend and says, "My, don't you think John has gone too far this time?" And you can and Gore Vidal's father, who was quite an interesting character, had read a copy of Myra Breckinridge, and his response to Gore was, "Don't you think you've gone too far?" So going too far, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. And sometimes I'll admit that some of the works that I cover, I find outrageous. I'm put off by them. I wasn't very familiar with Samuel R. Delaney, who's a science fiction writer of some note. He's still alive today. And he wrote this brilliant novel, Dahlgren. And that had scenes of raw sex. It had rape, things like that. Mm-hmm. But since I was dealing with him in this period of, I think it was 74 for that chapter, mm-hmm. he also had published a novel called Hog, which is absolutely disgusting. I can see how you can want to try and break down all kinds of barriers as a way of opening things up, and I respect that. On the other hand, I think, as some people have said, the point of going too far is also to go too far with a certain kind of logic, if not of not restraint, but of artistic knowledge in what you're doing. And I'm not sure that was always the case. But sometimes going too far can be illuminating. Like, Chris Burden invites his friends and I think it was 72, to come to this gallery room, and they're seated there, and they basically are told he will be shot at so-and-so time, and there's a guy there with a 22 caliber rifle who's about 15 feet away. Now, this could be a piece about work of art that cannot be repeated. It's a work of art that cannot be commercialized since he didn't sell tickets. It's not a piece that could be hung on the wall, stuff like that. But maybe it's also a piece about the interrelation between the artist and the audience. That is, does the audience have moral responsibilities when it comes to the work of art? In that, not a single person stood up and said, hold the phone here, Chris. I mean, this is great as a conceptual piece, but that's a real bullet that's going to be going into you, and no one did that. And in other pieces, the same thing would happen. So you could say what he was doing was testing the audience. In one piece, he was laying on the ground in Chicago, and a very young Roger Ebert was a columnist for the Chicago paper, and he's laying on the ground, and he's not doing anything, Burden. Hour after hour passes. Ebert was a big drinker then. He said, I'm going to the bar. Call me when something happens. A day passes. I forget how long it went. But finally, somebody came from the audience, which, as you could imagine, had shrunk quite a bit, and puts a glass of water next to Chris Burden where he's laying. At that point, Burden gets up, picks up a hammer nearby, and I think he smashes the timer and leaves. So maybe that piece was less about Burden's powers of endurance, but about the role of the audience in terms of not allowing some things that are outrageous, that are going too far, to occur. And the book is also about how, in part as a result of a Supreme Court ruling, the Brennan decision, the definition of pornography changed in the United States. That doesn't mean that there weren't, and there still are, debates about it, cutoffs in funding and all kinds of things, but that helped to open things up. And American culture started to open up in the early 60s. And so that's when the new sensibility, I think, became enmeshed in American culture.
Yeah.
Though not dominating it.
Right, right. So where can we find your book?
Well, it's available. In town we don't have a whole lot of bookstores.
Right.
They do have some copies, I think, at Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's available through Amazon and places like that. Yeah.
That's George Kotkin. He's just written a new book, Feast of Excess, A Cultural History of the New Sensibility. Thank you for joining us today on Issues and Ideas.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.